And you're listening to BBC Radio Ox 95.2 FM. I'm Bill Heine here in the hot seat until 12 noon. My guest right now is the General Secretary of the Open Spaces Society, Kate Ashbrook. And Kate, you've been chairman of the Rambler Society twice, two stints of 3 years each. You've been involved with the countryside, asking questions and trying to protect access to the countryside for most of your life. Where did this passion come from?
It started right back at the age of 10. In 1965, I visited Dartmoor in Devon for a riding holiday. I was a pony mad little girl, and so the joy of going on a riding holiday was just, you know, wonderful. And I kept going back because I loved the riding. And then suddenly Dartmoor got to me, this wonderful, wild, open space. It just got to me. I thought, this is amazing, when I was in my teens. And I discovered there was this wonderful woman, Lady Sayer, who had been campaigning all her life for Dartmoor. I managed to get to meet her. She inspired me so much. She was a really tough campaigner, completely fearless. I went to Exeter University in order to be near Dartmoor. I worked alongside her. She was 50 years older than me, but was one of those people who was ageless and just, you know, I felt that she and I were the same age, and we just campaigned together, and I learnt so much from her. And that was the start of it all, the campaigning for wild country.
Yeah, you say you learned so much from her. In your campaigns, what is it that you've learned that's helped make you a successful campaigner?
I think you must be single-minded. You must be very clear at whom you're aiming your campaign. Who is the person or organisation who will take the decision that will give you the outcome you want? And then you need to concentrate all that effort on making that person or body take the right decision. So you need to be single-minded, you need to be fearless, and not mind what people say about you.
Okay, this fearlessness, let's just tackle that one, because you've mentioned that about this woman who was your mentor, and it's something that has characterised your act. Activities, perhaps. Have you ever been intimidated?
I suppose, yes.
Wait a minute,
yes.
You're really hesitating.
Well,
here,
I'm trying to think if I've really been intimidated. Well, I was intimidated once because I did something really silly, which was to follow Lady Sayer. Because she had common rights on Dartmoor, she had rights to go across Dartmoor when the military were firing, and she had done that, and I knew she'd done that, and I thought, well, I'm going to test this system, because this is back in 1978 when they didn't have proper bylaws on Dartmoor. I thought, I'll test this system. I'll tell the military I'm going to walk across Dartmoor when they're firing and see if they stop. So I rang them up and said, I shall be walking across today. I then did walk across, and they didn't stop. And I must say, at the time, it was quite scary, but having kind of got into the middle of it, I had to keep going. And I did walk across the moor and back while they were firing. Yes, I was scared at the time, and it was probably a very silly thing to do. I then wrote to the military and said, you know, hey, you didn't pay any attention. And they did then make much stricter rules about public safety. So, yes, I was scared.
That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it was nutty, really. Yes. They put up a lot more lookout huts, which of course were ugly and things which we didn't really want. And I'm afraid I was probably to blame for that. But on the other hand, it was, you know, obviously the system wasn't working, and so I tested it.
Let's take a look at where you've tested the system and you've actually achieved positive results. What are your successes?
Well, I do feel very pleased that the footpath, which had been blocked by Nicholas Van Hoogstraten in East Sussex, is now clear and open, and that I played an important part in that alongside
the Ramblers. What's the part that you played?
I took various parties to court. I mean, I probably need to just explain a bit about the process. The law used to be that if you prosecuted somebody for blocking a path and the magistrates found them guilty, with any luck, they'd remove the obstructions, but there was no requirement to do so.
In other words, the law didn't have any teeth.
Yeah, it didn't have any teeth. And Nicholas Van Hoogstraten, or a company that he formed, Rarebug and Limited, had put up a barn, refrigeration units, padlocked gates, and a barbed wire fence across a public footpath in East Sussex. And he'd stuck two fingers up at the public and called them riffraff and scum of the earth and all that. And so when the Ramblers prosecuted his company and he was found guilty, nothing happened. That was at the time the Countryside and Rights of Way Bill was going through Parliament. So we used that to get a Van Hoogstraten clause put in the bill, which said that if the magistrates find someone guilty of blocking a path, they can then fine that person a daily fine and require the obstructions to go. I tested that law as soon as it came in. I tested it personally, and I had to go right back to the beginning, prosecute, rare bargain, and keep going back to the court because the obstructions weren't removed. At the end of the year, the magistrates had fined the company £90,000+. The obstructions were still there. Clearly, that clause was found wanting when you had a really determined landowner. I then took East Sussex County Council to court.
You didn't.
I did, because meanwhile, the County Council, instead of carrying out its legal duty of removing these blockages, had said to Rare Bargain, if you come up with another route, you know, we'll process that, we'll go through that process, which, of course, they shouldn't have done. And Rare Bargain did come up with another route, so they made what they call a diversion order. I prosecuted the County Council because that was against its policy, which was we will not divert obstructed paths when you can clear the obstructions. I went to the High Court, I lost, I went to the Court of Appeal, and I won. The effect of that judgment was that the diversion order that they'd made was quashed. The County Council was still saying, well, we're still not going to do anything about this, we'll just, you know, have a look at our policy. And fortunately, at that time, the land had gone into liquidation, because at that point, Van Hoogstraten's company, you know, had been found to be bankrupt and all that, and the land had gone into liquidation, and the Ramblers got together with the liquidator, who agreed that if the Ramblers paid to remove the obstructions, they could be removed. And so then we had a wonderful event on the 10th of February 2003 when we got the JCBs came in and I had the wire cutters, you know, and I was able to kind of cut the wires and get rid of the obstructions. So we did it with a combination of me personally taking various parties to court and the Ramblers doing a great job and funding the removal of the obstructions.
Have you had to do any of that kind of work here in Oxfordshire?
I don't think I've ever prosecuted anyone in Oxfordshire, but I'd be prepared to, you know, if there's a heavily obstructed path, most certainly, because, you know, people shouldn't get away with breaking the law.
Okay, let's take the temperature of access to the countryside in Oxfordshire. What's it like in the current climate? And you know what I'm referring to, the cuts.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, Oxfordshire County Council do a good job on rights of way, generally.
I'm sure they'll be glad to hear that.
Yes, well, I would say that, you know, they're one of the better ones. But we're talking about cuts of up to 40%. We don't yet know the figure. We know that environment is being targeted. I think social services is kind of the top one, and then environment. And environment includes rights of way and countryside access. So we're really worried, you know, that they're going to lay off staff, that they're just not going to be able to do very much. And if that's the case, paths may well become obstructed, and then Open Spaces Society, Ramblers, individuals may need to consider taking court action. We may take that action against Oxfordshire County Council. There is a fairly recent law which says you can take a county council or highway authority to court for failure to remove an obstruction which it has a duty to deal with. And so we might take the action against the county council so that the members realise that actually they can't cut the rights of way budget because they'll find themselves in court.
Well, if you've got a problem in the countryside, you want to get through to this program and get some input from Kate Ashbrook, well, she's the former chairman of the Rambler Society, the general secretary of the Open Spaces Society. It's 08459 311 111. The Carpenters there, and Goodbye to Love. Hello, if you're just joining us here on BBC Radio Oxford 95.2 FM, Bill Heineff, now until noon. Kate Ashbrook is with me here in the studio. She's the former chairman of the Ramblers Association and the general secretary of the Open Spaces Society. Kate, what's your take on the proposed sell-off of the national forests?
Well, see, absolutely appalled at the idea that this public land could be sold and public access to it could be lost, and indeed woodland could be used for development. You know, there are no guarantees.
Yeah, but does that apply here in Oxford in any way?
Oh, yes.
Oxfordshire.
Yes, because there are Forestry Commission woodlands in Oxfordshire. There's Cowley's Wood, Queenswood and Firebrass Wood.
Where are they exactly?
Well, they're on the top of the Chilterns.
Right.
Just sort of between Christmas Common and Stoke and Church. Mm-hmm. And then there's Waterperry Wood, you know, near Waterperry, another example. So, yes, there are extensive areas of Forestry Commission woodland that are much, much loved by the public.
So what is the threat here?
Well, the threat is that if they are sold, public access could be lost. At the moment, there is a right to walk on all Forestry Commission-owned woodland. They made a deed of access under the Countryside and Rights of Way Act, so that's good. But there's masses of permissive access, you know, the access that they allow to horse riders.
What's the distinction between permissive and...
Permissive access can be taken away at any time. It's not protected in law, and that's access for horse riders and cyclists, for instance. Also, the Forestry Commission provide trails and interpretation and picnic sites. You know, you get a good experience if you go to a Forestry Commission woodland. Now, if the land's sold, the legal access probably can't be revoked, but a new landowner could make it all very unfriendly, put up high fences, perhaps CCTV cameras, so that you wouldn't want to go on the land, or you couldn't get onto the land to enjoy your right. And as for the permissive access, well, that could just disappear completely. There's no guarantee.
I've heard some landowners say that the people who walk on the land are not an unmixed blessing. They bring their own problems as well, some of them. Well, would you accept that?
Yes, I'm sure a few people don't behave as one would wish. They may well not be people who are out there to enjoy the countryside, though. I mean, they may be people where, you know, rights make no odds because they're going to go there, you know, because they're up to something. I think generally people do respect the countryside. I would say there were very few problems. We can always cite problems anywhere in life, but I don't think it's a big problem.
Yeah, but there is a problem here, you think, about the sell-off of the countryside. Some people would argue that the Forestry Commission, it doesn't have a totally terrific track record in managing the countryside terribly well. Do you think we do very, very well in the management of the countryside?
Well, I think the Forestry Commission has come a really long way, you know, in the last 20 years or so. When it was first set up, it was there to, you know, create timber. It was a commercial operation, and we can look at large areas of the uplands which have had conifers planted on them, you know, very, very ugly. I mean, look at Dumfries and Galloway, you know, horrendous. But in the last few decades, the commission has changed out of all recognition. You know, there's mixtures of broadleaves. They're welcoming access. I think they are very good managers. I mean, we'll all, you know, I'm sure people can cite examples, one always can, of something that isn't going so well, but generally they are good.
Okay, now how real do you think the threat is to some of our woods here in Oxford? You mentioned the ones on the children, Cowley's Wood and the Queen's Wood and the Fire Brass Wood. I mean, do you really think that they could be sold off? They will be sold off?
If the government does what it says it's going to do, yes. And we had the Agriculture Minister, Jim Pace, talking to the House of Lords subcommittee on the 24th of November, making it very clear that they could well sell off all the Forestry Commission woodlands. And there's a consultation at the moment, which I urge your listeners to respond to, inviting views on this. But there is no option. Normally, in a government consultation, there is an option of do nothing. Leave things as they are. This consultation has no such option of leave the land in the ownership of the Forestry Commission and perhaps find more ways of involving communities. That is not an option. It's all about sale. I think this government is determined, but, you know, there's a huge number of people out there who've signed petitions and are protesting, so I'm just hoping that the government will think again.
Well, Silva, now that's a group that's based over there in right around Whitnam Clumps, and they're a very interesting group because they're focusing on woodlands. I mean, obviously, Silva, the word comes from forest in Latin, but they're running a poll on their website asking, should the state own forests in England? And the answers recently when I checked, are running at about 85% yes. So it seems like there's a great groundswell of support for the forest and against the government policy. But you're concerned that the government could still go ahead. When you first came on the program a few minutes ago, you said if you want to be successful in a campaign, you need to be single-minded and know the levers of power and make sure that you focus people on that. What are the levers of power here and how are you going to influence them?
The levers of power are parliamentarians, and I suggest that they are actually members, you know, in the coalition. So Conservative and Lib Dem MPs in particular, and I think that people need to write, you know, to their MPs very clearly, making it clear exactly how they feel.
Okay, let me just test you out here, because the MP for the Henley constituency, that's where your society is based.
Yes.
The Open Spaces Society. The MP there is a Conservative, John Howell. I think that his area takes in some of the woods that you've been mentioning, the Cowley's Wood and the Queen's Wood and mm-hmm. the Firebrass Wood. What's his position?
Oh, he's in favour of it. He's actually a government minister. You know, he's a housing minister. He is in favour of it. I think what we need to do is seek a meeting with him and actually talk about it. The society is based in Henley. Unfortunately, I personally I don't have a vote in that constituency because I live next door in Turville, so I'm Wickham. I need to talk to my MP for Wickham, Steve Baker. But that's what people need to do. They need to go to their MP's surgeries, you know, armed with the information, leave something with them saying how they want them to vote. And they had a vote in the House of Commons on the 2nd of February on this, and it seems to have gone pretty much on party lines, although not entirely. There will be further opportunities. The Public Bodies Bill, which is all about altering the Forestry Commission, will come to the House of Commons later this year, and there will be some big votes there.
Now, what's the nub of that particular one?
The nub of that is allowing ministers to alter the Forestry Commission without having to go back to Parliament. So it's very vague as to what they can do. It's sweeping powers given to ministers to alter the way the Forestry Commission functions. And
you're suspicious of it?
You know, very suspicious.
Why?
Of it. Because it's been published last October before any consultation on the forests, you know, giving ministers these powers before they've even tried to find out what the public thinks about it. So, you know, it does make the consultation look like a sham when you get that published, you get the agriculture minister saying, you know, we could sell off all the forests, and then you get the consultation coming along months later. It doesn't look like the consultation is very real.
Coming up, I'll play you an interview that I had with the Country Landowners Association, the CLA, their head in our area. He's got some questions about the Open Spaces Society, and I'll get your reaction to that one. Right now, here's Duffy. BBC Radio Oxford with me, Bill Heine, from now until noon. My guest here in the studio is Kate Ashbrook, the General Secretary of the Open Spaces Society. Well, Rupert Ashby is the Regional Director of the CLA, the Country Landowners and Business Association, for the whole of the Southeast. And earlier, I asked him about the CLA views on the Open Spaces Society.
We both look at access, but we look at it from a different angle. I think the Open Spaces Society is very keen on expanding the amount of access that's already there. We take a view that there is a huge amount of public access in England already available. There's nearly 190,000 kilometres of public rights of way, for example, 10 national parks covering 8% of the country. The problem is with the access is that, for instance, the national parks are extremely busy and suffer a huge amount of pressure from footfall, whereas there are large areas where there isn't any. And I think we would like to see a sort of focus on the existing rights of way and really, you know, making them up so it's a really good rights of way system, rather than looking for great areas in addition to what is already there.
So it's interesting. You do support their aims to a certain extent, but on the other hand, you think that there's already enough access?
Yes, I mean, I think there is. I mean, the Crow Act a few years ago opened out a load of open space, and I think 865,000 hectares of land were open for that. And I personally don't know quite how much that is used, but I don't think the countryside flocked out to use it. I mean, research shows that what the public are looking for is easy access. It's signed, quite likely to be a circular walk so they can return to their car or whatever transport route they've come on. And opening up sort of great long areas, maybe opening up linear routes, aren't so popular with the public because they don't necessarily fit the aims that they would like from access.
But is it true to say that there is an inherent dispute or difference of opinion between people in the CLA, the Country Land and Business Association, and people in the Open Spaces Society and the Ramblers?
There are conflicts at times. I think, like with all organisations, there are certain parts of the membership that come into conflict with the other parts of the membership of the other organisation, and there are some conflicts. I mean, we hopefully can get involved and sort of help to resolve that from our members' point of view, and the Open Spaces Society will no doubt do that from their members' point of view. And I think, you know, as long as what's happening, everything is done above board and legally, you know, that's all part of the way life works itself out. CLA staff and our officers, who are CLA members, will meet with Kate Ashbrook and her team. And for example, we run the CLA Game Fair every year, which is the largest travelling fair in the world. And we invite Kate Ashbrook along to come and put the Open Spaces Society, because it's only fair that, you know, we debate these things openly. We may not agree, but, you know, that's how the world goes round, is that we have a look at things like that. One thing that we are looking at, and we would love to engage more with people, is a new approach. A lot of rights of way currently go to places that no longer exist. There have been calls for opening up of rights of way that were there years ago but have fallen into disrepair or vanished, and people want to go back through the records and pull them up. Now, really, wouldn't it be better if we looked at the rights of way system and said, let's make it work for modern day England? And let's get those rights of way going to places where people want to go. Let's have a look. There's a path that goes diagonally across the field. I mean, I was in Devon this year. I was on a walk with my children. There was a path which went diagonally down a hill and then up a hill again. nearly wore me out because I had to carry my children back up it. But if that path had been changed to run along the top of that wall, I would have enjoyed a view the whole way and probably saved my pack for my children. I mean, there's an example where historically there was probably a reason why that footpath went that way. Wouldn't it be nice to change it? And these are the sort of discussions we would like to be having, rather than looking backwards and trying to dig up rights of way that go to places that maybe no longer exist.
Rupert Ashby there, the Regional Director for the Country Landowners and Business Association for the whole of the South East. Kate Ashbrook, so he's talking about looking forward to modern-day England's need and delight in rights of way, and I think he's suggesting that you're looking backwards.
We're looking at something that is part of our history and is absolutely unique. The rights of way network goes right back, you know, right back, and it is an important part of the history and the culture of this nation that we have those routes. The rule is once a highway, always a highway. So even if it isn't shown on an official map, if there is evidence that it's a highway, we have the right to walk it or maybe to ride it or even to drive on it. And that is so important. I think people don't realise it's part of the fabric of our nation.
Yeah, but doesn't he have a point there that a lot of these routes are linear routes going where nobody wants to go nowadays, and it would be better to bring them into line with what the current state of play is?
Well, it's a huge generalisation. I mean, there are paths that go all over the place, and if they go nowhere now, it's because it could be because they did used to go somewhere.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm sure.
And that is part of the history, and maybe don't let's move the path, let's think about where it might go on to. You know, if it's a dead end, for instance, it isn't really a dead end. Probably there's evidence that it should continue. So let's dig out that evidence and see, you know, where the highway goes.
Okay, but let's just take one example. People who live in mills. Now, in the olden days, there were all sorts of paths that would go to the mills because that was terribly important. Everybody had to get there from all different angles of the local community. Nowadays, the people who live in the mills have, maybe they're inundated with visitors traipsing by that they don't really enjoy that much. Maybe their enjoyment of their property is at odds with people's enjoyment of the footpaths that were old and valuable at one time, but now no longer necessarily so valuable.
It's really difficult to generalise. I mean, one, you know, we should look at each case. If there's a path that goes to somebody's back door because it was a mill and then it stops, and actually there are a lot of those in Cornwall, for instance, not mills, but just farm buildings, then there may be a case for moving it round the side of the building. But I have to say that every landowner who buys a property should have done the proper search and know what is there. And they buy the property with open eyes, knowing that there is a footpath that goes through it. And what really makes us angry is these landowners, people who move into the countryside, they buy an expensive property, and the first thing they want to do is move the path because there's a lot of talk about security and privacy. And then you think of the bulk of the nation who actually live right next to a pavement on a street in a town and who have walkers who can look into their front windows every day, every minute, you know, and you think, actually, these privileged people are just trying to kind of say, this is mine, and put a big fence around it. And that makes us really angry.
Do you think you could be described as having a chip on your shoulder when it comes to privileged people?
Not at all. I just want everybody to be able to enjoy their rights. And it's nice to be able to walk through a property and admire that property, not have to see it from a distance with binoculars. You know, and it's, there's no reason to shift the public out of the way. In fact, having the public there can be a help because it means that burglars aren't so readily going to go and break in if they know that any member of the public can see them at any time lurking around the property.
You're listening to BBC Radio Oxford. I'm Bill Heiner. My guest until noon, Kate Ashbrook, the General Secretary of the Open Spaces Society. If you have any questions about the countryside, are there any particular paths that you've found that they were closed or there was a dispute over access to them? Well, look, you have an expert right here in the studio. I say expert, well, it's Kate Ashbrook. She's the General Secretary of the Open Spaces Society. Twice she was the chairman of the Ramblers Association. And if you'd like to get her view, it's 08459-311-111, or you can email me. It's bill.heine, that's H-E-I-N-E, at bbc.co.uk. Hall & Oates, they're disappearing in the distance. Maneater, you're listening to BBC Radio Oxford 95.2 FM. I'm Bill Heine. My guest is Kate Ashbrook, the General Secretary of the Open Spaces Society. Kate, we haven't talked about greens and I suppose the access to village greens and the preservation of village greens and the future of village greens. We live in a particularly interesting county for village greens, don't we?
Yes, I live in Bucks, but yes, those who live in Oxfordshire, it is a special place for greens because there have been three court cases concerning areas in the county which have really helped to clarify the law on greens. I should say, first of all, that we're not just talking about the traditional area in the heart of the village with the oak tree and the maypole dancing
and the
cricket
pond, yeah.
And the pond. We're actually talking about any area of land which local people have used for 20 years for recreation. So not talking about walking on particular paths, but actually used the whole area for running around with the dog and playing games and picking blackberries. For 20 years, without asking permission of the landowner, without being given permission of the landowner, without being stopped. And if there is a bit of land in your community where that applies, then you may be able to register it as a green, and you fill in forms, you get witness statements, you put in your application to Oxfordshire County Council. The first case that came up was at Sunningwell in 1999, which clarified the meaning of the term as of right in the legislation.
How did it clarify?
Well, it clarified it by meaning the people didn't have to think they had a right. They just needed to have exercised this custom, really, for 20 years to gain that right. The next case was the one at Trap Grounds, which clarified all sorts of things. And
yeah,
was
right
really
here
helpful.
In Oxford itself.
Right in Oxford, yes. And that has been registered as a green now, a very good area.
Well, that was quite a powerful test case.
It was.
Wasn't it?
It went all the way to
the Supreme Court,
and it tested all sorts of things. And as a result, we got a clearer piece of law. And then finally Warnford Meadow, which is the one where the hospital wanted to build housing, an extensive area, which went to the High Court. So
And they won.
They won as well.
And, and I think that everybody was surprised when they won.
Yes.
Even the campaigners.
Yes. I mean, it was a brilliant battle. So we have had the law clarified. So, you know, it's worth looking around your community and trying to get the land on the register now. Don't wait for it to be threatened with development, because then it's a horrible fight against the developers, you know, as the Warnford Meadow people found, and can get very expensive. Try and get it on the register now. Once registered, the land is protected from development. It can't be built on unless the developer provides land in exchange, which is just as good as the land to be taken. So it is a real protection, but please don't use it spuriously just to try and stop development, because that really isn't good practice. It needs to be an area where you genuinely have that evidence.
Hmm. Do you, you've used the word developers there several times in that little interchange. Is the word, in your view, is the word developer a dirty word?
Well, I suppose I'm using it kind of generally, anybody who wants to build on land.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, some developments better than others, and it gets complicated when it's, you know, low-cost housing, social housing, you know, and there's obviously a community benefit there. So, no, I don't use it generally as meaning all bad, but quite a lot of it is bad, yes.
Mm. What about the future of village greens, though? I mean, where are we going on that front? Do you think that they're going to be under threat more in the future?
Yes. I mean, we're waiting to hear what the government's plans are for. They've talked about consulting on changing the village green legislation. We wouldn't.
For instance, why? What's on the agenda here?
Well, I think, it was the previous government started this. They said that people were using the provisions to stop development, and that big developments were getting held up because people had whacked in applications at the last minute. I think there's very little evidence of people doing that, very little evidence. There will be one or two cases, there always are. But I think the law can be sorted out, not by changing it, but by just clarifying it and having good guidance, requiring the registration authority, the county council, to stick to a timetable in processing a green application, making sure that everything's very transparent so that a developer will know that there is an application in the offing before he puts together his plans. You know, it's just better communication, really. We don't need to change the law, and I wouldn't want to see that. We've also, the government has talked about having a new designation of open space, similar to the site of special scientific interest.
Okay.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah,
you know, that's
exactly
all they've said. That's all they've said. You know, now we wait to hear more. I mean, we've been consulting our Open Spaces Society members as to what they'd like to see, and we're going to put together a proposal for government because, you know, nothing's happening.
But you actually put proposals together for the government?
Well, why not? You know, they've talked about this. They've been talking about it ever since the election. It's in the business plan for Department for Environment and the Department for Communities and Local Government with no further information. So if they can't get round to doing their thinking, perhaps we should do their thinking for them. So we'll put together some proposals and present them to ministers, yes.
You use the phrase, why not? You know, Robert Kennedy was quoted as saying, some people see things that are and ask why. I see things that are not and ask why not. Is that one of your phrases that you use a lot to open doors? Why not?
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way, but I should think it could be, yes. Yes, you know, there are things that could happen, certainly. Most of the time, I have to say, we are fighting against things that are happening. And my successes, you know, if I look back over the years, a lot of successes are things that haven't happened, things that have stayed the same, things that I've stopped, developments that I've stopped happening, or, you know, paths that I've kept in the same place, rather than the things that have happened. But then I see that as positive. I mean, people often say to me, you know, it's very negative, you're always campaigning against things. But I say, if you save something and you save it for posterity, that is really positive.
Kate Ashbrook, thank you.